Interview with Wuncher.
Out of operation. Mm-hmm. Now, either our contract engineers, you know, forced the contractors to do the same thing. So you might see anything in the other stages repeated. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was that intelligent that the contractors preferred to do it the same way as well. this is the assembly fixture still for Saturn 1.
This is here?
Yeah. This is all here. Mm-hmm. Because we did the Saturn 1 development entirely in-house. Mm-hmm. And after we had built 10 Saturn 1s, mm-hmm. we turned it over to Chrysler. Mm-hmm. So they came in a little bit too late to do any development. Mm-hmm.
Did this tooling and the fixtures and stuff go down to Michu then?
Yeah. We delivered this to Michu, and they might have built another set for that. But I mean, they did it exactly as a production contract, getting the complete set of drawings and everything and specifications. Because if you build already 10 vehicles, you know, and they mm-hmm. built another 10, it was just a complete subcontracting of a developed piece of hardware. Mm-hmm. They made some modifications for later requirements, some weight saving exercises, which mm-hmm. we largely had started to develop here, and then imposed it on them and said, you figure it out to the final stage. Okay.
Was the weight saving program going on all through the development cycle as you found new ways of doing things? Would you modify each vehicle as you went along?
Yeah, actually the R&D, the research and development was always justified mm-hmm. and only possible on that basis to be funded. To say, we have our present vehicle in development. Mm-hmm. It is already maybe in the prototype development, so that the drawings are already made and the motive or the configuration is frozen. But it could be that we have to save weight, for instance, especially in Saturn V, that maybe mm-hmm. the lunar payload exceeds the limits. And then somebody else has to make up for it. Mm-hmm. And that could be to make the first stage lighter, make the second stage lighter, and so on. So especially for the first stage, which we built here, the first four of the stages, before Boeing took it over, mm-hmm. I personally run a large structural development program in order to save 30% structural weight.
30%?
Yeah. Mm. We never incorporated that mm-hmm. program. We incorporated only a 20% tank weight saving by introducing one of the modes which I developed. Mm-hmm. But the others was then to go from titanium, from aluminum, basic material, to advanced technologies using titanium mm-hmm. and using roll diffusion bonding methods and changing the tank configurations. So,
are you talking about the S1C now?
Yeah, this is S1C. Because I have... We have a... I put this together. You might have seen this Research Achievements Review number 8.
Not yet. Doesn't mean that we haven't.
Yeah. Yeah. Now here that was when in
65 is the date, I think.
In 65, yeah.
Is that published mm-hmm. by the ME Lab?
No, this is a NASA okay. memorandum. You know, this is what Ernst Stuhlinger came up with, and we had mm-hmm. one afternoon for manufacturing research. Mm-hmm. And I worked this out that time, gave a short opening, and then our people talked about the different activities we are doing, and this is all with respect to technology development, welding mm-hmm. problems.
As opposed to forming, yeah, I think.
Yeah. It is our electric hammer development, mm-hmm. which I introduced in Swinghammer. Did the development. Yeah, we have manufacturing research in support of Cyclone 5, high-pressure liquid and pneumatic ducting systems, H-forming. Yeah, the H-forming was one of the major introductions. In a nutshell, the Redstone and Jupiter vehicle was a common dome configuration.
You mean a dome
yeah.
bulkheads?
Yeah.
On both ends, fore and aft?
You have always two tanks, you know, for the fuel and the oxidizer. And the one basic question in rocket building that was whether you make two tanks with the interstage piece in between, so this is here then the LOX tank, and this is here then the fuel tank. And you have an interstage in between, or whether you make one common container with a common dome, and this is then here, let's say, your LOX, and this is here your fuel.
Or the common bulkhead, or whatever.
This is a common bulkhead.
Yeah.
The Atlas, for instance, still has the common bulkhead. So had the Jupiter and the Saturn and the Redstone vehicle.
Would you do that now? Still use the common bulkhead?
In the Saturn class, we went to separate tanks. Saturn 1, because it had the clustered tanks, and it had one central LOX dome, and it had seven tanks around there with four more LOX domes and four tanks, you know, cluster tanks. So you had separate tanks. And then in the S1, in the booster stage for the Saturn V, we went to separate tanks.
What about the S2? Would you, in the S4B, if you're building those over
S4B
again?
S4B has a common dome.
Yeah.
And the S2 has a common dome.
Yeah. Would you still build them with common bulkheads if you were doing it over again, or would you go to separate tanks?
The bigger a vehicle gets, the more impractical it is to build the configuration in basically one piece. This is so. One factor is especially the size of the vehicle, because if you have one large stovepipe to install the bulkheads, and that is 33 feet in diameter and 80 feet long, then it is much harder to handle. You need much higher facilities. For instance, whenever you have to turn the stage upright, then no plane grain clearance is sufficient, and you also can employ only a smaller number of people. But if you break such a large unit down into the two tanks, you can have two assembly lines parallel. You can live with your buildings. So I mean, this is, let's say, one economical or one practical impact.
So that was one of the
that
good reasons,
one of
too,
the reasons
for the S1C having a separate tank. Right?
That was the main reason.
Ah.
You know, because everybody came and said, why don't you do it in a common dome motion? Because that, from an engineering point of view, could be lighter, which isn't true either. It depends on many other factors as well. And so more or less the beginners, they finally repeated what we had done in the Redstone and Jupiter, and tried to teach us and introduce the common dome, while we moved away from that, because if we would have built the first stage in one piece, we would have needed all new buildings. And in fact, this happened exactly with the S4B and the S2 stage, that in Seal Beach and in Huntington Beach, we had hundreds of millions of dollars building projects with new high bay areas, with new cranes, with new crane clearances, you know. Mm-hmm. The so-called assembly tower in Michoud, Boeing proposed to build 5 such assembly mm-hmm. towers just to go through a longitudinal panel weld and weld in one piece. While we built up the vehicle and had designed it that way from cylindrical sections. And there was one cylindrical section with a dome and one in between and one with the other dome, and these sections never exceeded the height of 40 feet. So we could use, and after we forced this into the scheme and we had built 4 vehicles, we forced that the Michoud plant, which was the biggest national investment, I think it was that time the biggest factory undercover in the whole world, mm-hmm. paid for by the Navy and the Air Force had it, and or vice versa. And we inherited that in order to build the vehicles, and it would have been unusable, you know, if you would have had the other design, because mm-hmm. it has 40 feet crane clearance, and this is what we had here. So we reduced the need for vertical assembly buildings to a minimum, at least to just one.
Mm-hmm. And you had to argue with Boeing about this.
Oh yeah, they tried that for a long time, you know, to soften up the management people who don't have any technical idea in order to prove that it was better, and that was connected with the $80 million building program.
Yeah.
You know, it was really nonsense to build the Seal Beach for the S2 stage, which was another $56 million investment, as much as I remember. Mm-hmm. And we turned it down for the same reasons and said, you know, it doesn't make any sense to force a $50 million building program just because you design your vehicle that way. Mm-hmm. We didn't do it that way, it's not necessary. It is rather much harder, you know, to work with one bulk item instead of broken down tanks and thrust frame and so on. It is, but Washington decided against that because California needed construction work. And the NASA program is more or less a make work program. Hmm. I mean, the money spending is only available because you have to keep the people busy. You have to.
So that's one of the reasons why the S2 wound up with the common bulkhead.
Yeah.
Now, Bill Parker.
That means we couldn't afford the building program going with it. It was rather even desired.
Mm-hmm. I see. Rather than build it more cheaply.
Rather than build it in instead of lengthwise, build it in cylindrical sections. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the cylindrical section thing, you know, had one drawback. That means whenever you have such a cylindrical section and you weld it, and you have longitudinal stiffening bricks, you have some stiffener pattern in there. Mm-hmm. You have to leave a large piece of weld land where you join with your welding, and here are then the ribs, you know. Mm-hmm. Because if you would join your thin skin here, there was no method known how to join the ribs, or the ribs have to fit in pitch, and that technology just didn't exist. So our design people, Sepp Blumrich and Eric Engler and Werbel, they designed this thing with the weldland. I developed then here in a technology program how to join a continuous rib pattern. And we made a triangular cutout and so on and developed the method. And that saved 20% tank weight. And that actually made the horizontal assembly mode to draw even with a longitudinal assembly mode. Mm-hmm. You know, there's also that. I don't know how technical you want to be in your book, or I don't know what the purpose of the book is, because these are just internal pressure vessels.
Mm-hmm. No, we want to make it technical if we can. Okay.
You know, the hoop stress in the pressure vessel, the multilunar hoop stress is twice as high versus the cylindrical or the cross-section hoop stress. Mm-hmm. So if you make cylindrical welds or circumferential welds, this weld area is half as stressed versus the longitudinal weld area. So that is favorable, you know, for the mode we selected. And that was another engineering point, because the aluminum welding through thick gauges, you know, there were two things. If you went to the thick gauge joint, you know, in order to compensate in that weld area for the missing rib pattern, mm-hmm. so that it wouldn't buckle there, we had to weld through about 1 to 2 inch of aluminum, which at this time was not yet feasible. Basically, the older types vehicle, the Redstone and the Jupiter, was welded from 50,000 series aluminum, 5,000 series aluminum, 5456. That is a magnesium-containing aluminum which work hardens. That's the so-called seawater consistent type of aluminum. Mm-hmm. And that is not affected by heat input with respect to strength, but it only is hardened by cold stretching. This is called work hardening. Mm-hmm. So that material was not used in aircraft because it is hard to form. As soon as you shape it, it gets harder and harder, and so in order to make the intricate aircraft wing noses and wingtips with deep pawing, the 5000 series aluminum, even if it is seawater consistent, that was the most unfavorable favorable aluminum alloy to use, and it didn't react to annealing. But it had, in general, a low strength level anyway. And an aircraft normally isn't welded, it's riveted, because aluminum wasn't considered to be weldable anyway. Mm-hmm. Now, when the missile production came up in aluminum, you have to build pressure vessels and they have to be welded. So that was the new technology task to solve the welding problems. In a high strength or lightweight structure, because the pressure vessel is the major structural portion of the whole missile. The missile is more or less the airframe is a pressure vessel.
Did the Atlas use aluminum or was that stainless steel?
That is steel.
Yeah. What about the Thor?
They used 2014 aluminum.
Okay, so that was the Thor the first big missile that began to use this stuff?
No, the Redstone was the first big missile, then the Jupiter was the second big missile.
Right.
Then the Air Force got in and built the Thor, repeating exactly the Jupiter. It was the same engine, it was the same size, the same performance. It was an absolute duplication.
What about the waffle construction on the Thor? Was that ever used on the Jupiter or any other missile up to that point?
No. And it wasn't used in the S-1C either, because the waffle pattern is not really the optimum for this type of structure.
Mm-hmm. No, I was thinking in terms of the third stage here.
We had longitudinal, the waffle pattern was reused then in the S-4B stage. Also the S-4B stage used a couple of, it used the same old slip-in bulkhead method. I mean, we proceeded actually from the common dome mode, where the dome was slipped into the pipe and it was lab welded here. You know, now naturally you have your outer wall And you have a certain step and a strength inconsistency from that eccentricity. And whenever you weld such a corner, you know where the bike head joins here, and you x-ray it, you always see that mating line in your telescoped, where your bike head or your section is telescoped into the other one. And you don't know whether this crack is a weld crack somewhere in the weld or whether this is your crack where the structure starts to split. It is also a natural crack propagating corner. So that is the weakness of any such lab weld, whenever you weld something together that way, mm-hmm. that you still have an unjoined area, which in fatigue life later will propagate a crack into the weld, on one hand. On the other hand, in your quality and reliability control program, you cannot clearly define whether this is already a crack or it's just your telescoping.
There, yeah.
So we fought this problem, you know, with the 5000 series aluminums. I mean, we used then the 5000 series aluminums because they were not heat sensitive. And for that reason, you could weld and you didn't lose much strength, mm-hmm. because they were work hardening. But they didn't reach the strength to weight ratio of the thermal treatment aluminums, like the 20,000 series copper containing. But when the welding technology progressed, you know, the automatically controlled welding methods, through the development of completely automated inert gas and methods, controlled with all type of electronic sensor systems. Mm-hmm. And really the welding machine is a very absolutely highly automated thing. Mm-hmm. We have spent many hundreds of millions here in our lab for development of welding technology. See, that might be the major contribution in that area for the general technology. Now, after we learned how to weld this 5000 series aluminum for really a structural weld application, I mean not just for a beer can or so, we progressed into the 20,000 series, 2014, which was used by Thor also. But 2014 is a 4% copper alloy. So 2014 is aluminum is 4% copper. Mm-hmm. Now whenever you weld this, the 2014, it was king in strength to weight ratio. 2014 fully heat treated. Was about 20% better than the 5,000, 5456 or so, the 5,000 series. But the weldability was marginal because of that 4% copper. And so you got so-called micro fissures and copper depleted areas, because as soon as you liquefy that, the copper just concentrates to a eutectic, mm-hmm. and you have then areas where the copper content is lost, and then you have the soft aluminum property. So the big problem in 2014 welding still exists, and it has existed throughout the settlement program. 2014 was then used for the S4B stage, mm-hmm. and it was used for the S2 stage. Now the S4P stage was contracted out first to Douglas, and they had recommended 2014, and they had done the lab welding method, like the shifted in bulkhead there, on the Thor, as we did it with the 5000 series on the Redstone and Jupiter. And they used also this type of technology. They did not go to butt weld. And they are not, you know, because the better churning method is, if you really can control your weldment, to butt weld.
Mm-hmm.
So that you get a continuous structural configuration.
And you can check the crack structure much better too.
And you can absolutely control it. So the more reliable weld and the more sound structural principle is butt welding. But in aluminum, we didn't dare with the early Jupiter vehicles to do that. S4B stage didn't dare to do it. And we didn't dare even in the Saturn program to do it. With a copper containing material, because that was harder to weld. So the strength to weight ratio, or let's say the strength to weight ratio advantage of going to the 20,000 series copper containing alloys was, like in the S4B, completely wiped out by still resorting to the old lab weld technology and applying a much higher safety ratio. So the ductless welds are only loaded to 20% of their achievable weld strengths for uncertainty reasons and safety reasons inherent in that critical welding problem.
Could you make
Now we used here at Marshall, we used nevertheless a copper containing alloy, but that was the 2219, which is a 6% copper alloy, and which wasn't considered to be weldable at that time, which is in fact the old 1909 Dur aluminum alloy where the first airships were built from. This was the Dur aluminum, highest strength aluminum alloy with 6% copper, which is a eutectic point in the copper aluminum series. Mm-hmm. And Alcoa in their Canadian plant had taken up this Dur aluminum production, I don't know, some years ago. Mm-hmm. And they had verified the alloy a little bit, you know, with more ingredients. And really this whole metallurgy is like cooking, you know, you put a little bit, half a percent of titanium in. And in fact, we hired a metallurgist who was 25 years with Alcoa as a metallurgist, yeah, and that was a spinster. Herb Brennecke, she's now over there in materials. So she's a good cook and she's a good aluminum maker, because you have about 6, 7, 8 ingredients and you put a little tip of salt in it and pepper it, and you never know what happens, you try it out. So, I mean, this metallurgical alloy is a great alloy.
What's her name again?
Herb Brennecke.
Brennecke,
B-R-E-N-N-E-C-K-E.
Brennecke, okay.
Yeah. So Alcoa actually improved the old Dural by some small fraction of percentage ingredients, especially titanium. To a weldability range, I mean, to make the welding feasible of that alloy.
Mm.
And in fact, Boeing pioneered this use of a weldable, of that 6% copper alloy, 2219, with their Bomark missile.
Mm-hmm.
They had a 30-inch diameter tank in the Bomark, 30-inch, just a little bit more than 2 feet. And that was 2219, and that was welded up in butt welds. And we went there to Seattle, that must have been in 1960 or 59, and studied that. And finally, after maybe 1 or 1.5 years of metallurgical and wet development, selected this for the S1C stage.
2219.
Yeah. Now, today, 2219 is the only considered reliable aluminum alloy for any future vehicle.
2014
is really on the way just out because of that critical behavior with 4% and non-eutectic and so on. Now, the strength, there's one interesting fact, the strength to weight ratio, I mean in the fight for strength to weight, I mean the whole fight in aircraft and missiles is material wise higher strength to weight ratio at the joining. I mean like welding if you need a tight pressure vessel or riveting or some other joining if you don't have to seal. Now, this 2014, which was developed not for welding but for king in strength to weight, and which is used in aircraft, which is a heat treatable alloy. Whenever you anneal it, it gets soft like cardboard. So you can deep draw it and form it. And then you age it again and it gets really in strength to weight ratio 20% better than any other alloy. You know, that for being riveted together and not welded, that is still up to date the top-notch aircraft